From NPR and WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. It's Here and Now. Today in Baltimore, the city's top prosecutor, Marilyn Mosby, announced that Freddie Gray's arrest was illegal and that his treatment in police custody amounted to murder and manslaughter. And she announced criminal charges against six members of the Baltimore Police Department.
Officer Caesar Goodson is being charged with second-degree depraved heart murder, involuntary manslaughter, second-degree negligent assault, manslaughter by vehicle by means of gross negligence, manslaughter by vehicle by means of criminal negligence, misconduct in office for failure to secure a prisoner, failure to render aid. Officer William Porter is being charged.
Mosby then read all the charges against the remaining officers.
Joining us now from Baltimore is NPR national correspondent Jeff Brady. Hello, Jeff.
Hello, good afternoon.
So we just heard Marilyn Mosby reading some of the charges. What other details can you give us about them?
Well, nobody was really expecting an announcement like this today, and there are a lot of charges there in there. Some of them carry very long prison sentences. If there's a guilty verdict, when this case goes to trial, the most serious charges have been filed against, as you heard there, Officer Caesar Goodson, second-degree murder, involuntary manslaughter, and other charges. Sergeant Alicia White also has manslaughter charges filed against her and other charges. Four other officers face a variety of charges, including false imprisonment. And that's because officers detained Freddie Gray without probable cause, according to Marilyn Mosby. She says he committed no crime when he was arrested.
And I see that second-degree murder charge, if found guilty, can carry a penalty up to 30 years. Jeff, tell us a little bit more, if you could, about this false imprisonment charge. Did Mosby, give more details about the events leading up to Gray's arrest and death?
Yeah, we do have some more details, and this is what the protesters here in Baltimore have been demanding, and quite a few more details released today. A lot about that ride, from the moment he was arrested to the moment he was taken to the hospital. She talked about how he was put in the van. He wasn't secured as he was supposed to be, suffered a neck injury when he was in the van because he wasn't secured. And Mosby said that there were several times that officers could or should have called for medical help, even a few times when Gray himself asked for it. But those officers didn't call for medical help. They actually went to pick up another prisoner. And Mosby says that one officer, Alicia White, she spoke to the back of Gray's head at one point, and she didn't get a response. She said that White didn't try to assess Gray's condition or call a medic. And by the time officers tried to remove Gray from that van, he was not breathing. He went into cardiac arrest. He was rushed to the hospital, and then he died a week later.
And today, Marilyn Mosby also had a message to protesters in Baltimore and the rest of the country. So let's listen to what she had to say.
To the people of Baltimore and the demonstrators across America, I heard your call for no justice, no peace. Your peace is sincerely needed as I work to deliver justice on behalf of this young man.
So briefly, Jeff, how are people reacting?
It's a celebration, really. People were driving near that CVS drugstore that was looted and set on fire on Monday and honking their horns. You'd almost think the trial was over, but that is exactly what people want here. They want a conviction in this case. But, of course, there's a trial to get through before that.
NPR's national correspondent Jeff Brady in Baltimore. Jeff, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, this week, the Federal Reserve kept the door open to an interest rate hike in June. But with the U.S. economy at a near halt in the first quarter of 2015, and with its 35th straight month of low inflation, it's possible the Fed won't act until next year. Fine. But what does that mean for you and for any of us wondering how to handle our money? Personal finance columnist Jonathan Clements has some advice. He writes for The Wall Street Journal, and his latest book is The Jonathan Clements Money Guide 2015. Jonathan, welcome.
It's great to be with you, Peter.
First, what kind of inflation are we seeing now, and what is considered normal?
Well, currently, if you look at the 12 months through March, we actually had negative inflation. Inflation fell 0.1%, but there's a big reason for that. We've seen a collapse in oil prices over the past year. If you take out oil prices and you take out food prices, over the last 12 months, we've had inflation of around 1.8%. That's pretty low by historical standards. Over the last 10 years, inflation has averaged around 2%. If you look at the real longer term, it's closer to 3%.
So as I see these headlines about low interest rates and low inflation, I think a lot of people probably don't know exactly what to think. So who stands to lose? Who stands to gain when conditions are like this?
Well, I think we need to take a step back and say, if you're an investor, if you're a saver, what is your goal each year? If you're looking to make the purchasing power of your money grow, you need to earn a rate of return after taxes that is greater than the inflation rate. So let's take an example. Right now, you can go out and you can buy a 10-year treasury note, and that 10-year treasury note is going to yield around 2%. If you're in the 25% income tax bracket, after that 25% is taken out of your 2%, you're earning 1.5% after taxes. Meanwhile, core inflation is running at 1.8%. So net-net, the purchasing power of your money is not growing, and that is not a good thing as an investor.
That is a huge problem. Also, if you are, say, nearing retirement, and traditionally people who are nearing retirement put their money in these kind of vehicles, in bonds, in CDs, certificates of deposit. So if these really low yields are a reality now, what am I to do if I'm 60 years old and all of a sudden I'm at the end of my career and I'm facing this?
You have a series of unappetizing choices. There are three major asset classes when it comes to saving and investing. One of them is so-called cash investments. What we're talking about here are things like certificates of deposit, savings accounts, money market funds. Even if you look hard today, you'd be hard-pressed to find a one-year certificate of deposit that's going to yield much more than 1%. So clearly, if you own a CD, you're not going to make very much money. You could take a little bit more risk and go out into the bond market. There, you might be able to get yields from 1.5% to maybe 3%. But once you step out into the bond market, you're facing so-called interest rate risk. In other words, if interest rates go up, the price of your bonds are going to go down. What's the other alternative? Well, that brings us to the third major financial asset class, and that's stocks. And of course, you know, we all know what can happen with stocks.
They're risky.
They are extremely risky. So what should you do? Well, clearly, it's going to vary from one investor to the other. But in many ways, the best thing to do is own a little bit of everything. That way, yeah, you might own something that's not going to have great returns over the short run, but you also, with any luck, will have some investments that do well. There's a good chance that over the long haul, you'll make money, and you'll make money while not having too many sleepless nights, because thanks to the cash investments you own and thanks to the bonds you own, you should have a relatively calm portfolio.
Yeah. With yields on a certificate of deposit, CDs as low as they are they even relevant anymore? Is anybody investing in them?
One of the strategies that some of my friends have been doing is going out and buying, say, a five-year CD. If you buy a five-year CD these days and you really hunt around, you can find yields over 2%. That's not great, but if interest rates head up from here, and people are betting that it probably will happen in the years ahead, and suddenly there are CDs available that yield 3 or 4%, what you can do is you can cash in your CD, pay the early withdrawal penalty, which might be equal to 90 days interest, and then you can turn around and invest in the higher-yielding CDs that are now being issued.
Well, let's be honest. I actually have many more years of work ahead of me. So let's go the other direction. What if I am just starting out in my career? I just got out of school. Where do I put my money, and do these conditions matter to me?
What do you think about just coming out of college? You probably have a negative net worth. In other words, you've got student loans and no assets to your name, and yet you do have this one incredibly valuable asset, and that incredibly valuable asset is your so-called human capital. It's your income-earning ability. When academic economists look at human capital, the way they view it is equivalent to owning a huge position in bonds that's going to pay you steady income, like the interest from a bond, for the next 40 years. Because you have this huge position in your human capital, the way to diversify that is to go out and buy stocks. Historically, the investment that's given you the best shot at having inflation-beating, tax-beating returns has been stocks.
We've heard also, Jonathan, a lot about the Fed. What is the Fed going to do about interest rates? And we thought it was going to be in September. Then we heard maybe December. Then we heard, well, is it going to be 2015 at all? But I wonder, when we actually do see the Fed make a move on interest rates, will we suddenly see a big jump in these investments that we've been talking about? Or will it take a long time to integrate in?
If we see the economy really heat up, if we start to see inflation regularly above 2%, yeah, I think we'll see short-term interest rates rise quickly. And for a lot of savers, that'll be a source of relief. They'll be happy to earn more in their savings accounts and their CDs. But the question is, should they be happy? Because even if they're earning a little bit more in their CDs and a little bit more in their savings account, after inflation, they may actually be worse off than they are today.
Hmm. Jonathan Clements is a personal finance columnist for the Wall Street Journal. His latest book is The Jonathan Clements Money Guide 2015. Jonathan, thanks very much. It was helpful.
It's been my pleasure.
The 141st running of the Kentucky Derby takes place Saturday at Churchill Downs. American Pharoah is the favorite. The 3-year-old colt will be ridden by jockey Victor Espinoza. He guided California Chrome to victory just last year. Now, there are 20 horses in this year's field. None of them will be ridden by African-American jockeys, which is quite a change from the early days of the Derby when black jockeys were a significant presence in horse racing. Janelle Johnson from Here and Now contributor WFPL in Louisville reports.
William Walker, 1877. Garrett Lewis, 1880. Babe Hurd, 82.
Erskine Henderson, Isaac Lewis, 87.
Alonzo Clayton. That's Kentucky Derby Museum curator Chris Goodlett. He's reading a list of the names of all the black jockeys who rode winning horses in the early years of the Derby.
15 of the first 28.
The history of black jockeys in the Kentucky Derby goes back as far as the event itself. Oliver Lewis, a black man, rode Aristides to victory during the inaugural Derby in 1875. And black jockeys remained prominent in racing until 1902, when Jimmy Wingfield won on Allendale in the 28th Kentucky Derby. Then, for decades, nothing. So what happened? I asked Goodlett and turf rider Teresa Gennaro from Brooklyn Backstretch.
All of a sudden, you have generations of black horsemen who had never known slavery. They were independent, autonomous people, and white people began to feel really threatened by that.
Jimmy Wingfield, an example of African-American jockey who, while riding in Chicago, instances of jockeys, white jockeys, kind of ganging up on him during the race, riding him close to the rail.
They were treated terribly. They were victims of incredibly racist and violent acts. Their lives were put in jeopardy on the racetrack.
And as far as trainers and owners are concerned, if, you know, other riders are ganging up on their jockeys, they don't necessarily want to ride that jockey.
And a lot of them just gave up.
On top of that, the Southern economy collapsed after the Civil War. Black families migrated north and to jobs in factories, not on farms. So the absence of African Americans in racing is complicated. And until recently, most people had forgotten about their connection to the sport. But some were still working to commemorate the early winners of the high-stakes race.
The black jockeys were role models for the young black men. And when we realized that people didn't know about black jockeys, that's when we started the celebration.
Shirley Mae Beard is best known as the owner of Shirley Mae's Cafe, a small soul food restaurant in Louisville's Smoketown neighborhood, a historically African-American community. In 1989, Beard founded the Salute to Black Jockeys who pioneered the Kentucky Derby. The free carnival was created to inspire youth in the neighborhood and to educate people about African Americans' contribution to the Derby.
At Derby time, I wanted them to know that this is a time for them to celebrate and be just as proud as everybody else because it was the black jockeys that started it.
Beard doesn't hold her annual carnival anymore, but she still has black jockey memorabilia hanging on the cafe's walls. The Kentucky Derby Museum also has a permanent exhibit, African Americans in Thoroughbred Racing, to recognize the achievement of black jockeys. Curator Chris Goodlett.
We often get people who are surprised by the story. It is a new sense of discovery for someone every year.
In 2013, Kevin Krieger was the first black jockey to ride in the Derby in more than a decade. He didn't ride the winning horse, and turf rider Teresa Gennaro and Shirley Mae Beard are skeptical Krieger marks a turning point in black jockeys returning to prominence in thoroughbred racing.
If you look at a lot of the families in racing now, they've been in racing for generations, and they've passed down the love of the horse and of horse racing from generation to generation. And where that would start with a new generation of people of color, I think, is the big question.
Someday it may be and someday not, but I doubt it because there's so much money involved.
It likely won't happen this year. There are no black jockeys scheduled to ride in the 141st Kentucky Derby.
Oh, no. You got to be off good.
For Here and Now, I'm Janelle Johnson in Louisville.
Y'all come back and see me.
It sounds like the name of a horse running the Kentucky Derby, but it's not. Penny Dreadful is Showtime's critically acclaimed horror series that starts its second season on Sunday. The first season brought together characters from 19th century English literature like Frankenstein and Dracula, and they're intertwined into a story about the abduction of a young woman. Season one is chock full of vampires and exorcisms. Critics agree it's actually scary. NPR's TV critic Eric Deggans is here to talk about the upcoming season. Hi, Eric.
Hey.
So let's get right to it. Here's a clip from Sunday's upcoming episode.
Master, my beloved Lucifer, I have found her for you, and she shall be yours. I shall assault her days and her nights, her dreams and her prayers. No corner of her soul shall be safe. Every beat of her heart she shall know. Only suffering. I will not fail you. I will not fail you. I will not fail you. Your anus.
Okay, so creepy. what makes this show so good? Is it just that scary stuff?
Well, first, let's explain that that voice that everyone heard is sort of the voice of who seems to be the main villain in the second season of the show. The way Penny Dreadful works is it reimagines these classic horror villains that we've come to know over the years. And in the first season, there was a lot about reinventing the vampire myth, and we were introduced to Frankenstein and Frankenstein's monster and Van Helsing, and all of these characters were sort of tweaked and reimagined. Dorian Gray, we know them, but we don't really know them because in this world, they're a little different than the characters that we're used to. So now in the second season, witches seem to be the main villain. And the voice we heard was the voice of the main witch, the head witch, who is a disciple of Satan and seems to be coming after Eva Green's character, a medium who has been sort of at the heart of this team of do-gooders who have tried to challenge the forces of darkness in 19th century England. It's a really intricate series, and it reimagines a lot of different horror tropes that we've seen, and they do it really, really well.
Yeah, and one of the show's strengths is considered to be its setting, as you say, in 19th century England. And I don't know, maybe there's something when you're talking about witches or Lucifer that just seems scarier when it's in Victorian England. But what do you think makes this time period so appealing?
Well, part of what's appealing about it is that it's the time period where a lot of these myths really took flight. When we think about Frankenstein's monster, when we think about when vampires were really became a part of popular culture, they all kind of sprung out of this period for us. And so it's good to go back to that period. I like period pieces, though, because they're a way of getting some distance from some of the things that we're struggling with in our own life. So I always say that period pieces are never really about the period in which they take place. They're about the period in which they are made. So even though Penny Dreadful takes place in the 19th century, the things they're struggling with, some of the characters are struggling with, this ongoing sense of decay that they're fighting, this wondering how to deal with roles of what's expected of women and what's expected of men. This is all kind of subtext in a lot of the stories. This is stuff we're dealing with now, but we get a little distance from it when it's placed in a story that takes place in the past. And of course, it's fun to see all the dresses and corsets and all that stuff too. So.
Right. But you know, the horror genre is not an easy one to pull off. We're going to play a clip now from a show that you've pointed to as a bad example of how to do horror. Here's a dream sequence from Netflix, Hemlock Grove.
Did I make a wrong turn through a wormhole into a subterranean novel where a top secret baby is being cared for by a demonic she-servant of Rainuary?
Eric, there are times when to me, Penny Dreadful feels a little overdramatic and maybe a little campy, but there's a difference here between these two shows, isn't there?
Yeah, most definitely. Well, you know, okay, so Hemlock Grove is also an attempt to sort of reinvent classic horror tropes, but it takes place in a modern setting in today's time. And I think that's one of its weaknesses, strangely enough, that you don't get a lot of distance from the story because it takes place in modern times. And it's telling that Hemlock Grove is probably the first series that you can officially say that Netflix has canceled. And if you watch episodes of Hemlock Grove, you will understand why they made that decision. So.
Well, what do you think? Does Penny Dreadful have staying power for a season three, a season four?
Well, certainly Showtime seems invested in the show. They are spending a lot of money to make it look nice, beyond the fact that I think it's well written and it has some great actors in it. You've got Timothy Dalton, you've got Josh Hartnett, plays an American who gets wrapped up in this. You've got Billy Piper. I think it's going to be around for a while because Showtime has shown that they're willing to spend money for the lush production, for a great cast, and it's well written, created by John Logan, who also wrote Gladiator. So,
all right, NPR TV critic Eric Deggans, thanks very much for scaring me.
Always a pleasure.
And it's the sound of silence for Groove Shark. The popular free music streaming service announced it's shutting down after a 6-year legal battle with the music industry. The industry claimed Groove Shark violated copyright law. Here now is Mike Regan of Bloomberg News. Mike, welcome back.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So at one point, Groove Shark had 35 million subscribers, but could you just remind us how it was actually different from other free streaming services, say like Spotify?
Well, in theory, Groove Shark operated by allowing people to stream the music collections that were uploaded by other users of the site. And the idea was that people are sharing each other's music, so theoretically, Groove Shark thought it didn't have to pay royalties. Spotify and the other streaming companies have royalty agreements with artists and the music industry, so Groove Shark was basically subverting that whole arrangement.
Yeah, and so did the argument that the industry was making was that the company was simply just stealing the music?
Well, what Groove Shark did is encouraged its employees, people that actually worked for the company, to upload a lot of music themselves. And the record industry really latched on to that, saying, look, this isn't exactly peer-to-peer sharing. This is the company having its own employees upload the music. So that was basically the whole, you know, the main gist of the complaint.
Mike, the industry feeling vulnerable, probably. We've seen cases like this before, and it's seen a really large drop in revenue from recorded music sales. Did that have something to do with this?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, the revenue of the music industry has been absolutely devastated because of the switch to digital, not only because of piracy, but when you think about it, if you like a song, even if you want to buy the song, you'll go onto iTunes and download just that song, where back in the day you had to buy the full disc, the full CD or record.
Right.
So that's a big part of it. And the revenue coming into the music industry has dropped dramatically. The bleeding appears to have stopped to some degree. The latest numbers from the RIAA, the industry group, put it at just under $7 billion, which is down about half a percentage point. And that's on a retail basis. So it seems to have stabilized to some degree, but certainly not growing.
But here's what I don't understand. I mean, clearly this is a victory for the music industry. But as I said, it's not the first time we've seen a music service sued by record companies and shut down. I mean, look what happened to Napster and LimeWire. And I just don't understand why Groove Shark wasn't able to look at what was happening with its predecessors and change its business model.
Well, it is a good question. And Groove Shark has actually been around for a long time, almost a decade. And they started off as sort of a Napster model where it was peer-to-peer, but you actually downloaded the music. And then they thought when there was all the pressure for sites like that to close down, they thought they could get around it by making it a streaming service, but it didn't quite work out.
So what do you think? Can music labels now rest easy that this case is over?
You know, this is certainly a big win, but I doubt anyone's really resting easy over it. And the problem is, for the music industry, it's sort of like playing whack-a-mole, mm-hmm. because you shut down one site like this, but there's so many others that pop up all the time. So you have to go after each of them. And as this lawsuit showed, as you mentioned, it's 6 years in the making, so it really can take a long time to shut these places down.
Yeah. Mike Regan, editor at Bloomberg News, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Our journey tracking the legacy of President Abraham Lincoln 150 years after his death is nearing its end. I've spent much of the past week or so traveling through Ohio and Indiana, retracing the route of the president's funeral train. And we finally arrived in Springfield, Illinois, the president's hometown. This weekend, Springfield will remember and reenact Lincoln's funeral at the Oak Ridge Cemetery. The president's body arrived in the state capitol after a 1,700-mile train ride from Washington, D.C. It passed through a dozen big cities, and it said 7 million people came out along the way to pay their respects. That's a quarter of the northern population of the country at the time. I met Ian Hunt, a historian with the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library, at the cemetery. He says when Lincoln's body arrived, the city was overrun with mourners.
The city fathers were imploring the citizens of the city to open their homes to strangers because there were literally so many people here. They overwhelmed what few facilities existed for staying overnight. And we have stories about walking into people's homes, and in their front parlor were people sleeping shoulder to shoulder on their floor that they had never met before. So it would have been huge crowds, huge procession, and it was probably the saddest day in Springfield history, at least up until that point.
And this had been a journey that had been going on for about 2 weeks. I imagine it was sort of a relief to arrive. Do you know, like, what the mood was? It was sad, but it was also the end of the journey.
There was a lot of anticipation with the president's body arriving back here. There had been some concerns that because the journey had taken so long, that time would have taken its toll on the president's corpse. They actually moved up the date of the funeral in Springfield because it was decided while the train was passing through Buffalo, New York, that the president's remains were not doing as well as they had hoped. The original date for the ceremony in Springfield had been May the 6th, and officials traveling with the body actually wired ahead and said, you need to move the date up a few days. So there was some anticipation about that. There was, I have to imagine, just some sense of excitement, muted excitement, that they were bringing Abraham home. He was the most popular adopted son in the city.
Hunt is standing in front of the vault where Lincoln's body was first held. A few feet away, a white oak tree once stood that cast shade for the funeral choir 150 years ago. People called it the Lincoln Vault Oak. It grew strong and tall as the years passed, but in 1992, architects and town officials worried the now towering tree's roots and branches threatened the historic vault. So the white oak came down, much to the displeasure of arborist Guy Sternberg.
And it, to me, it was just as valuable as the vault was. It was living history that continued to go through time, and you could see it in photos of the funeral, this little tree that had shaded the choir.
Sternberg lives among flowering dogwoods, blooming buckeyes, and 750 different kinds of oaks at the Star Hill Forest Arboretum near Springfield. That's where he told me that when the tree was cut, he and a friend managed to salvage the stump. When they cut into it, a history project began.
And we found where the acorn was. It had germinated in the fall of 1844. And as you count rings in the tree, of course, it only grows a few inches that first year and a few inches the next year, so it takes several years to get up to knee height. So you can go up and take cross-sections at that point and see 1845, 1846.
So the tree was about 20 years old when the funeral occurred.
Right.
And when you took the dissection of the stump, it sounds like history starts to get peeled back and reveals itself when you start looking at this thing.
When you look at the tree, it's like peeling an onion. And, of course, the outer ring is the most recent ring. And the outer ring in this case was 1992, which was the year that it was cut that fall. And what we found was changes in growth rate. We found places where the tree had been nicked here and there in the past. We found a blue stain, which was very significant because ferrous metals make blue staining in oak sap. So if you drive a nail or a steel staple or something into a tree and you sever the vascular system, the blood flow, if you will, of that tree, the sap, the acid in the sap protects the nail. It causes a blue reactive stain that goes up and down in the tree through that vessel system. So whenever you see a blue stain, if you're a sawmill operator, you stop right there because you know there's steel in that tree someplace or iron. In this case, we wanted to find what it was, so we took that entire section to the hospital and had a fluoroscopy done of it, which is as I understand it, like a live x-ray where you can move the tree around and see inside of it.
You took the tree stump to a hospital?
We took a 12 by 12 by 24 inch section, about a 150-pound section to there. But we knew where that section had come from. We knew exactly what year and which direction it had faced and so forth, because whatever was in there, we wanted to know what year it was put there and what direction it was on the tree, so we tried to piece together what had happened. And we found two old-fashioned nails, the old square-cut nails, in the tree. They had been driven in 1936, and they extended into the tree to, you know, about five more years, and extended out of the tree another 3 years to 1939. Once we found it by x-ray, we used that and set up and measured and opened the tree up and found the two nails, and they are still lodged in the piece that we've salvaged.
And what do you think was going on at that time in history to get those nails inside the tree?
Well, one can only speculate, you know, like CSI, you don't have a lot of evidence, but we know they were driven probably in the dormant season or the fall of 1936. And if you look back in the records, October 11th, 1936 was when they had the celebration of the Servius Tullius stone at the monument. The Italian government had given our governments years earlier a stone from the wall of Rome that had been built by their emperor Servius Tullius, who they considered their version of Lincoln. He was freeing the slaves and so forth. And not knowing what to do with it, they sort of shelved it for now in the Capitol basements, and it was there for years. And upon finding this, the Italian ambassador was going to be visiting Springfield, and he had said, "I'd love to see what you did with the Servius Tullius stone." And everybody's saying, "What Servius Tullius stone? Where is this thing?" Well, they found it under some trash and empty boxes in the basement of the Capitol. So they very quickly went over and mounted it on the upper level and on the front of the tomb and had a dedication ceremony that day. And we know from the records there were thousands of people in attendance, and I would speculate that the nails were driven for a traffic barrier or a sign or something pertaining to that event.
What else did you find when you started peeling back the layers of the onion?
We did find one thing that I just found tremendously interesting, and that was there was a place on the uphill side of the tree where the bark and a bit of the sapwood had been scraped off, scuffed off, and someone had taken some sharp instrument like a scythe and basically gouged out the bark and a little bit of the sapwood below the bark, and I speculate that was to clear the site for Lincoln's choir because it would probably have been full of brambles, and so if you look at the site, there were a lot of little sapling trees, and there probably would have been blackberries and things in there. You know exactly when it was because the scythe took out part of the 1864 growth ring, and the 1865 growth ring started to go and close over it. So it was between those two times.
Well, the Lincoln Vault Oak may have fallen, but it's still yielding secrets from history. And before it fell, the tree left a trace of itself that's still living today at Guy Sternberg's Arboretum. All right, so we have walked down the hill from your home, and here we are standing in front of what looks like a dormant tree, but again, this is a descendant of the original Lincoln Vault Oak.
Right, this was a one-year-old seedling that had germinated from an acorn that fell from the oak and landed on the upper wall of the vault. And there were several of them there, and a friend and I got four of them, managed to make them live. And this is one of two that we have here at the Arboretum. We'll be propagating off them, and in fact we already are grafting off them to restore a new Lincoln Vault Oak from the old one back in the same place again.
And it's still sleeping, and it's a beautiful spring day. I imagine Right. Not too long from now we're going to see this tree bud out.
Right, and if you look at it, this is the degree that the parent tree would have been budded out during Lincoln's funeral. You know, the buds were just beginning to swell, but it had not been any real growth yet.
Wow, and this tree could be standing here for 300 years.
Oh, at least. A number of things that could take them out, but they have the potential, just like you and I have the potential to live to be 100, they can live to be at least 500.
Guy Sternberg at the Star Hill Forest Arboretum outside Springfield, Illinois. You can see a video that we put together at the tomb where Lincoln's body was received. It's at hereandnow.org. In one of the old photos from that video, you can see the young Lincoln Vault Oak standing vigil.
David Wildstein, a former Port Authority official in New Jersey and Chris Christie ally, pleaded guilty in federal court today to playing a role in shutting down lanes of traffic during rush hour on the George Washington Bridge, a move taken as political retribution against the mayor of Fort Lee, New Jersey, who refused to support Governor Christie's bid for re-election. New Jersey Attorney General Paul Fishman also said today that the buck does not stop with Wildstein.
The federal grand jury has returned a 9-count indictment charging William E. Baroni, Jr., who was then the deputy director of the Port Authority, and Bridget Ann Kelly, the former deputy chief of staff in Governor Christie's office, with the same scheme to misuse the property and resources of the Port Authority to punish Mayor Sokolich for not endorsing the governor. That calculated scheme created havoc for Mayor Sokolich, his constituents, and violated various criminal laws.
Steve Adubato is a political analyst in New Jersey and former state legislator. Welcome, Steve. And can you just start by telling us what exactly did David Wildstein admit to doing in court today?
Basically, David Wildstein said, yeah, it was me. I was the architect together with Bridget Kelly and Bill Baroni. We did this. We concocted this scheme. We were the ones who were less than thrilled, peeved, if you will, that the mayor of Fort Lee, Mayor Sokolich, was not going to be endorsing Governor Christie. And we were going to get him back by, frankly, giving the shaft to the people in Fort Lee and the surrounding areas by using their influence at the Port Authority to shut down those lanes. Huh. They did not, as far as we know at this point, implicate anyone else. It is the three of them. Wildstein took the lead on this, and that's what that – I'm not a lawyer, but – that's what that plea sounds like.
Right. And as you said, as far as we know so far, but I mean, how significant is it that Wildstein has not only said that he's guilty on these two conspiracy counts, but that also there are indictments that were announced against Balboni and Kelly as well?
Well, listen, these names have been floated around since this whole story, you know, broke. And these are people who have different kinds of relationships with high-level people in New Jersey, you know, particularly the governor. But the governor said at that press conference, that press conference that was covered by everyone in the media, we're all watching, the governor said, I didn't know about this. The governor said, these people, whatever they did or didn't do, they did it without my knowledge. If, in fact, what was said today in public by David Wildstein in open court is the truth, then that's what apparently or allegedly happened. Now, I don't know what else is going to come out after this, but these are high-level people. Bill Baroni was, in fact, a high-level person, the number one person in New Jersey at the Port Authority. Wildstein was the political appointee in New Jersey at the Port Authority. Bridget Kelly was the deputy chief of staff in the administration. These are not low-level people messing around with people's lives. They're high-level people.
Mm. Well, this is not the first time, as you mentioned, that we have heard rumors that Wildstein had discussed these closures with Chris Christie. Is it any more significant, though, now that Wildstein's attorney actually mentioned it in court?
You know, this is the problem with speculating. We don't know what his attorney actually has said to the U.S. attorney, Paul Fishman. There's a difference between what the attorney, Alan Ziegas, says in public and what he actually says in private to the U.S. attorney. And since we don't know that, to engage in speculation as to what he did or didn't actually say to the chief law enforcement officer, the federal law enforcement officer in New Jersey, Paul Fishman, the U.S. attorney, we don't know that. Mm-hmm. And so the governor, so far, unless he's an extraordinarily great actor, has said, this has nothing to do with me, I'm not worried about it. And it's going to be interesting to see what he says now, because if what is said publicly is consistent with what he said, then maybe he doesn't have anything to worry about. But we don't know what was said privately.
Yeah. Well, to your point, Mr. Ziegas spoke outside the courtroom, the courthouse, after the hearing today, and he said that while Wildstein could not undo what had been done, he could, quote, shed truth on what occurred in the course of that week, what led to the events, and what ensued thereafter. I mean, Steve, I just have a really quick question. I take your point about speculation, but this is also, like, big-time politics we're talking about. Maybe it doesn't matter to Chris Christie in the long run, but certainly for as long as this story is in the air and there is an ongoing case, it's got to have some kind of impact on his presidential ambitions.
I want to be clear. I said that's what he said.
Right.
I didn't say it didn't matter. In fact, it matters a lot. And Chris Christie would be the first person to tell you that he may not think it matters to his leadership and his being governor or a presidential candidate if he chooses to do that. But it has clearly hurt his candidacy for the presidency. It has hurt his standing among many people in terms of how they perceive him. That's totally different than a legal question. It's totally different than what did or didn't happen. The perception of Chris Christie has changed dramatically, significantly, politically. Mm. He knows that. Anyone who understands politics and understands life with common sense knows that this has hurt the governor in many, many ways.
Right. Steve Adubato is a political analyst in New Jersey and former state legislator. Thanks so much for joining us today, Steve.
My pleasure.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. It's Here and Now.